the month in review. It was a September of blue skies and sunshine and politics. The month started with a special session of the legislature in which Republicans blocked bond measures and Democrats came back with an expansion of ranked choice voting. Meantime, Maine's congressional delegation is navigating the impeachment inquiry of President Trump. Maine's new vaccination law will go to referendum, but some who signed the petition say they were tricked. Governor Mills spoke before the United Nations about climate change, and the entire state watched in horror and sadness as a huge explosion leveled a social service agency in Farmington, killing a fire captain and injuring several others. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Which stories mattered most to you? We'll discuss the Maine news of the month on Maine Calling next. But first, this news update. From the Maine Public Radio studios, I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. Today, our panel of editorial page editors returns to discuss the top stories in Maine from the past month, from the special legislative session to the explosion in Farmington. Joining me in the studio, Greg Kesich, editorial page editor for the Portland Press Herald and Maine Sunday Telegram. Ben Bragdon, editorial page editor for the Kennebec Journal and Morning Sentinel. And joining us from our Bangor studio is Susan Young, editorial page editor for the Bangor Daily News. We appreciate you all taking the time to be here. And we want to hear from you and the audience. You are part of this discussion. Which issues this month mattered most to you? What are you talking about with coworkers, family members, neighbors? Our phone number, 1-800-399-3566. You can send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to the Maine Calling Facebook page. It was a very big month of news in September, but I think the biggest story, Ben Bragdon, was the explosion in Farmington, an entire building and several homes obliterated. Turns out that it was a big propane tank had leaked 400 gallons of propane under a parking lot, if I remember correctly. You know, a firefighter killed others in critical condition. I think that the people of Maine all have watched and followed every detail of the story so closely, not only because they care about the firefighters and what happens to the people who are served in that building, but also it just strikes close to home, even if you don't live near Farmington.
Yeah, it really says a lot about, kind of small town Maine, small community Maine, and also how kind of this whole state is a lot like a small community together. One of the first things I kind of noticed as this news was coming across was that some of the firefighters involved had the same last name. You know, Captain Bell, who tragically died in the explosion. His brother is the fire chief and was at the site. And there was a couple other who were there who were related. And as we started to report it out, you also found that people around town knew these firefighters, for their whole lives. And also other firefighters from around the region and around the state knew them because that is such a small community.
They train together.
Yeah, they train together.
They help each other out, yeah.
Right, they have mutual aid agreements. There's a lot of struggles with the fire departments now. They're largely volunteers, so it's really a way of life. It's not so much just a career or a job. It's a way of life that you have to commit to and that your family has to commit to because you can at any point leave to go fight a fire. And so something like this spreads very quickly around the whole state, so everyone really feels it.
Yeah, I thought it was interesting. I mean, it's tragic and very sad, even more so than another kind of accident, because of who Captain Bell was. He was a very dedicated public servant. People don't go into this line of work because they want to make a lot of money or it's glamorous. It's a dedication to protecting your community, and usually that means you're helping people. In this case, he lost his life.
Mm. Susan, the Bangor Daily News did a story this morning.
We're actually working on an editorial about it, like we've seen with so many other issues, that outpouring of support reminds us of what a great small town Maine is. 27 fire departments from across the state are currently staffing the Farmington Fire Department because with the injuries, they are so short-staffed. So fire departments from Augusta, Auburn, Bangor, Bar Harbor, without anyone asking them, have coordinated to show up in Farmington and staff that station day in and day out. Some departments are staying multiple days. So that's an amazing thing to see, just, you know, people stepping up. But at the same time, this tragedy highlights an ongoing problem of shortage of firefighters, police officers, other emergency personnel. As Greg said, these are really difficult jobs, and you really have to have that commitment to public service. And unfortunately, you know, Maine's population is aging, so there's fewer people of the right age, but also fewer people willing to make that kind of commitment. So towns are continuing to really struggle to fill their ranks. And the Farmington, you know, was a horrible tragedy, but reminds us of that problem going forward, that we've got to make policy changes to make sure that communities have the firefighters that respond when there is an emergency.
Yeah. And talking about the response, I was struck by the governor's brother, Paul Mills, had a column in yesterday's Lewiston Sun Journal, and he talks about having a conversation with Charlie Webster. He writes, "Charles Webster, the former head of the GOP state committee, told him this: because I've lived my life in politics, sometimes people who do not always agree with you will avoid you. So what happened is that people I had not talked to in years, people I've known for a long time because of politics we hadn't really talked, went out of the way to reach out to me, and we talked about our families and things we had in common. That was nice, how it used to be and how it should be now." An explosion like this kind of maybe sometimes reminds us that politics isn't everything.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, sometimes, you know, when you have something awful happen in your own life, you know, it gives you a chance to kind of reflect on things and kind of get some context and kind of drop some of the foolishness that we carry around with us every day. And in this case, it happened to a whole community at once. I mean, you heard when the call went out that a senior firefighter had died, and they hadn't named it yet. You know, everyone that heard that knew someone who it could be, and at that moment had to think about, you know, kind of what was important in life. And it seems like it really had a far-reaching effect in that community.
It strikes me that, you know, now that we know the cause, is there a continuing conversation in, okay, so there was a propane leak, it caused this horrible thing. People all over Maine are trying to find new ways to heat their homes. You know, we're trying to do our best in a difficult situation, especially in rural Maine. Does this bring up a question about using propane, or is this a freak accident?
We don't know. The investigation is ongoing. I mean, obviously something went terribly wrong, but there was a construction on that site. They had a new addition. Was it something that to do with the construction? Was it something to do with the installation of the tank? The tank was just filled 3 days earlier. Was there something done? You know, and I'm not, or something else. I'm not pointing fingers at any of those areas, but you know, the heating with propane is not a new development.
Right.
I mean, people have been doing it very successfully for a long time. So there's a lot of work that's going to need to be done with that investigation.
All right. Well, let's move on to other topics. Another bit of big news is that our governor addressed the United Nations, and she addressed the United Nations I believe it was the day or 2 days or 3 days after she appointed the members of the new Climate Council, really ambitious goals for Maine's Climate Council goals for curbing emissions in Maine. Susan Young, as you look at these goals, do you think, given the political situation in Maine today, that they are achievable?
That's a really good question. Time will tell. But we have to remember, we already get a lot of our energy portfolio from renewable sources. Of course, there's some debate about whether biomass energy is truly renewable or not. So unlike some states, Maine's already moving in the right direction thanks to hydro and other green sources. Clearly, we need to increase the amount of energy that comes from solar and wind, and as you hint at, still controversial among some lawmakers who think that those sources of renewable energy are a scam or a waste of money. But I think we're seeing, you know, more and more communities. MDI High School just installed a lot of solar panels on their roof. Individual homeowners are installing alternative energy as well. So, you know, the market is moving too. So, you know, consumer demand may play a much bigger role than what policymakers have to say. But, you know, it's good after having Maine been very hostile to alternative energy under the previous governor to see the state moving in the right direction, committing to fulfilling the goals of the Paris Climate Agreement, dropping out of a group that wanted to promote offshore drilling off the coast of Maine, to see the state move in a direction that's more welcoming and promoting clean energy.
Ben, we had members of the Council on Maine calling last week, and they committed to this isn't going to be one of these big special councils that holds lots of meetings and comes out with a report, and then that report gathers dust. They plan to be rolling out action as they go through their process.
Yeah, I mean, it seems to be a pretty aggressive timetable and a pretty aggressive group of people. But, you know, hitting these targets in this state is going to be difficult. A lot of it has to go towards transportation. That's where most of our emissions come from. That's where, you know, Governor Mills has some incentives for electric cars, and that can help. But that's still a very tiny part. So, to really, put a dent in these numbers, you have to tackle some things that are like day-to-day life for people. Cars and heating, and there's some real barriers there. But that said, setting these targets, saying that it's important that we go after them, and then pursuing these other things that kind of on the margins can really help the state, regardless about it, moving people more towards heat pumps, which is going to save people money, promoting offshore wind, which could really be like an economic driver, could really be a new industry for this state. Those sort of things can really help out. I think, setting these goals, the governor's saying, this is important and we can do this and you should too, because that's the important part.
Yeah, I'm very optimistic, not in terms of, I mean, we have to be optimistic because otherwise the planet gets really hot and we all have to move to, Antarctic zone. But I think what's happening is we're not looking at this just as an environmental issue where usually environmentalists are pitted against people who want to do something and say, like, don't build that plant, don't don't release that chemical into the atmosphere, don't release that water into the river. This is going to take a real economic transformation in terms of where our energy comes from and how we use it. And it's not going to just happen by saying no. People are going to have to be able to say yes to a lot of things, a lot of different infrastructure changes into the way we live. I got a letter this morning, a letter to the editor saying, oh, this is just the first step. They're going to tell us what to eat and what kind of car we can drive and take away our personal freedom. And that's part of it. I mean, part of it is we need a political effort to explain and make the case for why we have to make all these changes. And it's not just saying no to releasing carbon. It's saying yes to all kinds of other changes in terms of how we produce our energy. So you really need to start out with the goal. And maybe that's the easiest part, but at least she did it. And she set a goal.
Yeah. Susan in Cape Elizabeth writes an email related to this topic. She writes, the growing public recognition of the threat of climate change is the most important issue for me. This includes the wonderful coverage covering climate now by hundreds of media outlets last week. Governor Mills' speech on Maine's initiative. She was the only U.S. elected official invited. And the massive turnout for the climate march last week. I hope this issue receives continued, sustained coverage. So, Susan, thank you for sending an email in. If you'd like to send an email, it's talk@mainepublic.org. Our phone number, 1-800-399-3566. Our Facebook page is always a place you can post a comment, or you can tweet at Maine Calling. So anything we're talking about in Maine today is really overshadowed by the national news and the impeachment inquiry. Susan Young, two members of our congressional delegation have expressed support for the impeachment inquiry, but that is only half. Who stands where?
Well, Senator King and Shelley Pingree are in favor, at least of the impeachment proceedings, not necessarily of impeachment itself. Jared Golden still, has a lot of concerns about what the president is alleged to have done, but wants to see more evidence and let the process play out more before he determines what the appropriate resolution is. And Senator Collins has said, the House is in charge of impeachment and she'll let the House do its work. And it's incumbent upon her as a senator to not comment on what the House is doing. So that's where the four of them stand.
Not to be cynical, Ben, but it seems as though all four are taking a position that is politically expedient at this point for them.
Well, certainly Shelley Pingree is in a fairly safe seat in a pretty left-leaning in district. And Angus King just won an election, and they both have a little bit more freedom. Jared Golden and Susan Collins, of course, are kind of balancing trying to balance what's going on in their districts. Jared Golden was elected in a very close race in a district that President Trump carried 2 years before. So he's, back in August when the Mueller report came out, I think he said, "I'm not hearing anything about this impeachment BS when I go out there." He was kind of dismissive of it, and he caught some flack for that. He's very exact when he talks about this. He basically says what everybody else is, a lot of the other Democrats are saying. He just doesn't mention the word impeachment. He says, "Let's look into it. We need to get all the facts. This is serious. There's nothing more serious than this, and we need to investigate it," which is what is going on. So he's just not coming out. He's one of just 12 House members, Democratic members, who are have not come out in favor of impeachment explicitly. Nine freshmen, I think they're all in districts that Trump carried. So, I'm sure a lot of Democrats would like him to be more forceful. He's also have to consider that a good number of people in his district support the president and kind of have to be carried, slowly towards this and explained little by little why this is so important to hold the president accountable. And, Susan Collins is kind of the mirror of that. She's, she says she's on the jury, so she can't comment. But, no senator is going to get pulled from this jury for commenting on it beforehand. So that's convenient. It's the same thing that Senator King said a lot through the summer, too. And he's now kind of tipped over. So I think the senator's she pushes back a little bit on the president's antics here or there, but she's going to have to weigh as this goes forward, how going against the president or staying on his side is going to weigh in her reelection. And the Democrats are pretty happy to put her in that position. That's part of one of these outcomes of impeachment, is that it's going to force all these senators that are in these tough states to go on the record. And we're going to find out more and more. We just don't know what we're going to find out, I guess. And that's going to be on her shoulders the whole time.
Greg.
The president makes it very hard to be in the middle regarding him. Yeah, either you're for him or against him, and it's very narrow ground to stand on, to be taking a wait and see attitude with him. I thought it was interesting that I think it was this month, maybe it was in August, Golden came out and sort of, as far as I could see, unprompted, said that he was not going to endorse the Democrat who was running against Collins in 2020. And it's unusual. First of all, Democrats, I mean, party members never endorse in primaries. It's very unusual for anybody to come out this early in a race to say that they're going to be neutral. But to come out and say you're going to be neutral in the November election regarding somebody of the opposing party. And I think what that says is he's very aware of the politics of his district. Again, like Ben said, I went for Trump by 10 points in 2016. And she's also aware of her position as the only Republican in the whole New England region of either the House or Senate. And so they're both trying to the extent that they can and the extent that events allow them to take a position in the middle and saying, you know, we're going to sit and listen. But at some point, that's not going to be possible. And that point might have already came. If you read the whistleblower's complaint, it is shocking and it's impossible to read that as far as I can see and say that there's no need for more inquiry. I mean, which is all they, with all the 218 Democrats who said they're for impeachment. They're not for impeachment. They say they're for an impeachment investigation. So I think it's going to be hard for both Senator Collins and Congressman Golden.
We're talking about the month of September of news in Maine. If you'd like to join the conversation, 1-800-399-3566. Our email address, talk@mainepublic.org. You can tweet at Maine Calling or post to our Facebook page. We'll be right back.
Listener support brings us Maine Calling with help from Evergreen Home Performance, helping homeowners address climate change with energy audits, window replacement, and insulation. More at evergreenyourhome.com. New England Cancer Specialists, proud to be a member of the Dana-Farber Cancer Care Collaborative. Learn more at newenglandcancerspecialists.org. And Breakwater, curiosity for life, offering exceptional day school and after-school options for toddlers through 8th grade. Breakwaterlearning.org.
In the 1970s, oil companies faced an uncertain future, and in looking to diversify, several of them got into solar energy, funding early critical research.
I'm no fan of oil companies, but I have to be fair when thinking about who did what when.
Big Oil's role in helping to launch the solar industry and the latest on the push for impeachment. This afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
This afternoon between 4 and 6:30 here on Maine Public Radio. Heard enough news? Love classical music? Perhaps our Maine Public Classical station is just what you need. Never heard about it? Maine Public Classical has a presence in 7 areas around the state. Portland, Bangor, Waterville, also in western Maine in Fryeburg, on the southern coast around Boothbay and Brunswick, one down east, and also now in many areas of York County. Where and how to find Maine Public Classical is at mainepublic.org. Classical music is timeless whenever you have the time. Maine Public Classical.
Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on the program, the news that made headlines in September. My guests, 3 editorial page editors, Susan Young with the Bangor Daily News, Greg Kessich with the Portland Press Herald and Maine Sunday Telegram, and Ben Bragdon with the Kennebec Journal and Morning Sentinel. We invite you to join the conversation. Call 1-800-399-3566. Send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, and post to our Facebook page. Something we haven't really discussed yet is that this month started way back then with the special session of the legislature in which the Republicans blocked several bond measures. And in response, Senate President Troy Jackson brought out a bill to expand ranked choice voting. Well, on the line with us now is Mal Leary, Maine Public's chief political correspondent, and we have invited Mal back to clear up some confusion over that ranked choice voting measure. Mal, welcome back. Last week you were a guest in the show. We touched on ranked choice voting, how it'll apply in the primary and general election, and there was some confusion. So do your best to clarify, if you would please, sir.
Well, there was confusion because I guess the best way to describe it is a little twist in the Constitution. Normally, when a bill becomes law without the governor's signature, it takes effect 90 days after the end of that session. But the special session, in which this bill was passed did not last long enough to reach the 10-day threshold. Therefore, the ranked choice voting bill will not take effect until 90 days after the new session comes into play in January, which puts it into late in the spring. Now, to make this all the more difficult, there's a separate bill creating the presidential primary, which specifically says the presidential primary has to be the first Tuesday after the first Monday in March, which means when you put those two disparate dates together of when legislation takes effect, ranked choice voting takes effect as a law a few weeks after the presidential primary. So it will not apply, the ranked choice voting, to the primary, although it will apply in the fall to the general election.
Is there any chance the legislature or any way that the legislature could change that if they wanted to?
Oh, absolutely. And that's part of the problem that makes this difficult. For example, because there will be a primary twice in the spring, the presidential primary in March and the so-called regular primary where we have Senate and legislative candidates in June, they could move that date from so-called Super Tuesday to June and save $122,000, which is what has been appropriated to pay for the cost of a presidential primary standalone. They could do that, or they could change the legislation and move the whole question of ranked choice voting to earlier. That would take an emergency preamble, and since Republicans do not like ranked choice voting, that's a more difficult, I think, change whenever you're talking a emergency piece of legislation. Although the argument would be, of course, to the Republicans, hey, this, if we couple this with moving a date, that saves some money. So the bottom line is we made a mistake in terms of when the effective dates would be on the legislation. And what we talked about was how it would apply to both the primary and general election, when, of course, it only will apply as it stands today to the general election.
Thank you. Boy, that is...
What's so hard about that?
Right, yeah.
It seems pretty straightforward.
Yeah.
Confusing.
Well, and for most of us voters, it means that unless the legislature does something really dramatic when they come back into session in January, we will not be voting in a ranked choice kind of primary ballot in March, but possibly
for president. But we will be voting ranked choice voting in the rest of the primary elections that occur in June.
Gotcha.
Just to confuse things a little bit more. Right.
Mal, thank you so much for taking the time to clarify that. And that was very clear, although very bizarre. Thank you, Maine Public Chief Political Correspondent Mal Leary. And I want to circle back to the reason that this ranked choice voting bill came up, or the believed reason, is because the Republicans did something that the Democrats and the governor did not expect when we came back into the legislative session. Ben Bragdon, everybody kind of expected that the bond measures, especially the one that would help internet rural broadband, sure, would pass, and suddenly it didn't.
Yeah, it was a little bit of a surprise, especially to the Democrats and to the governor, I think. Had a she had put forward, Governor Mills had put forward a pretty big bond package, I think back in the spring or maybe the summer. That had got whittled down. The question back then was we had a transportation bond, which is the big one. It pays for our roads and bridges to get repaired every year. And they had that bond and three other smaller ones. And the Democrats wanted to vote on them all at once back in the earlier session. The Republicans wanted to split them up. They couldn't come to an agreement on it. Finally, they agreed to split them up and handle them in the special session. The Democrats kind of assumed that at least the roads and bridges one would get passed, and they thought they would get votes on the land conservation package and then the broadband internet initiative was the big one, and they thought that has a bipartisan support. But lo and behold, we came to the special session and only the roads and bridges one passed. And the Democrats were kind of left standing there wondering, you know, what happened.
You know, I think there was a sense among Republicans that they hadn't had much influence in the session all last winter and spring, that the Democrats had the majorities, big majorities in both houses, and were able to get through their major policy priorities. And this was a case where you needed two-thirds in both houses to pass the budget and pass the bond issue, send it to the voters. And so they had some muscle here. As far as I could see, they didn't use it to negotiate to get a deal on something else. And I suppose that they could do that when the legislature comes back together in January, that they could, there will be the issue of these borrowing packages will come up again, and maybe they'll have some leverage. But what happened is that that these bonds don't go forward. People don't have a chance to vote on them. They included land for Maine's future, which is always a very popular issue with most Mainers, and other infrastructure investments in addition to the broadband that have a real impact. And they're the kind of things that you expect to borrow for, building National Guard facilities, things like
right.
that.
And when we use the shorthand voting for bonds, the legislature is really voting for the public to be able to vote
correct.
On bonds.
Correct, yeah. To send them out to the voters. Yeah. And roads, I think there's a real legitimate policy question. Why are we borrowing $100 million every 2 years for roads? They used to be kind of self-funding through the gas tax. And that has eroded over time to the point where it's this huge regular event that we borrow so much money for the roads. But they have very strong backers out in the community, the construction companies and the what they call the sand and gravel crowd has a lot of influence over what mm-hmm. happens in Augusta, and that crosses party lines. That's one area where people don't get partisan.
Susan Young, thoughts on the special session?
Well, especially on the bond package, I think the die was cast when the bonds were broken into four yeah. separate pieces, as Ben mentioned. Mm-hmm. I mean, Republicans have long advocated for voting on bonds this way. Their argument is that the public votes on each individual bond issue, for example, the broadband, the transportation funding, LMF, wastewater, and drinking water. And so why shouldn't the legislature vote separately instead of voting up or down on one big bond package? So it's an argument they've been making for a long time. And this year, they were successful in getting Democrats to agree to that. And so once it was broken apart, I think Democrats lost a lot of their leverage, because in the past they knew Republicans really wanted the transportation funding, so they kept everything together, and the Republicans would vote for things that they didn't really support. And this instance, Republicans voted for the transportation funding, but they did not have enough votes for the other pieces. So it's a lot of disagreement over what kind of agreements were made and who said what. But as Greg said, it was an opportunity for Republicans to use their little muscle they had to shut down something that they have long not approved of. And Jennifer, to your point, I mean, the real sad thing is they weren't approving this borrowing. As you said, they were just going to give Maine voters an opportunity to consider the borrowing. And now with what happened in the special session, other than transportation funding, the public doesn't get to say whether these other projects are a priority for them or should get funded. So, you know, at one point, Governor Mills was so frustrated, she said, you know, maybe I shouldn't have even called you guys back. So, you know, it wasn't an entirely productive special session, but, you know, we've got the transportation bond going forward. And at some point, we will vote on the presidential primary using ranked choice voting, not this time, but if barring any changes to the law 4 years from 2020, we will.
Yeah, the interesting thing you say, Janet Mills was frustrated. You know, she spent a lot of the session kind of fending off the Democrats who wanted to go forward full speed because they had the House and the Senate and the governor's office, and she did not want to appear to be kind of pushing things down, just just kind of steamrolling Republicans. And to have this happen afterward, kind of be shown like, you know, thanks for your consideration, but we're just going to kind of screw you over here on the end. I wonder how that's going to affect going into next session. I've had a couple of Democrats tell me, you know, why did we do that? Why did we split up those at all? Why did we even consider, handing this olive branch to the Republicans if they were just going to slap it away? So that's going to be interesting when they come back for the next session.
We'll go to Bob calling from Long Island, Maine. Hi, Bob. Go ahead.
Yes, thank you very much for taking my call. I have a safety issue here that I think is important to point out. In the case of gas, you've got a shutoff outside the building. All code says shutoffs outside the building, not only for gas, but also for electricity. So a fire department shuts off the gas and shuts off the electricity, and nobody goes into a building. Once it's been evacuated, nobody goes into a building looking for a gas leak. No, you shut the gas off so there's no gas in the building. I don't understand why nobody's mentioned that. It is code in the city of Portland. In my apartment houses, all buildings have gas shutoffs outside the building. And so you shut it off, you stand back, you let the gas dissipate, and then you go and look for a leak after the gas is gone. This was an unfortunate disaster. And the hero here is Larry Lord, who took people out of the building. But once those people were out, there was no need for those firemen to go in that building until all the gas was gone. That was not good.
Bob, thank you so much for your call. I'm sure this is going to be part of the investigation. You all are nodding. This is the kind of information that we're still waiting for, and I really appreciate it. We do need to go to a quick break. When we come back, more of your comments and questions. Thanks for hanging with us. We'll be right back.
Listener support brings us Maine Calling with help from Now You're Cooking, a cookware store offering kitchen tools, bakeware, and fine wine on historic Front Street in downtown Bath, open 7 days a week. Bull Moose, celebrating the tactile experience of reading and proponents of dog ears and bookmarks. Locations across Maine and at bullmoose.com. And Bangor Savings Bank, helping businesses with local service and decision-making. Bangor Savings Bank. You matter more. Member FDIC.
I'm Greg Dalton. On the next Climate One, with oceans on the rise, climate gentrification threatens to destroy a community's culture.
Once the water comes in, Little Haiti will be beachfront property. Bottom line, it's going to be beachfront property. It's going to be the new shore. So it's become like the hottest toy on the shelf.
A Tale of Two Cities, Miami and Detroit, on the next Climate One.
That's coming up in just a few minutes at 2 o'clock.
On the next Fresh Air, actor Antonio Banderas talks with us about his long collaboration with Spanish filmmaker Pedro Almodovar. Their work together began after the death of Spain's longtime dictator Franco, when it was possible to break old rules. Banderas now stars in Almodovar's new film, Pain and Glory, as a director dealing with physical and psychic pain. Join us.
And you can join us for Fresh Air this evening at 7 o'clock, right here on Maine Public Radio.
Welcome back. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You're listening to Maine Calling. Today on the program, The Month in Review, my guest, Greg Kesich, editorial page editor for the Portland Press Herald and Maine Sunday Telegram. Ben Bragdon, editorial page editor for the Kennebec Journal and Morning Sentinel. And Susan Young, editorial page editor for the Bangor Daily News. If you'd like to join the conversation, 1-800-399-3566. I'm going to go to a Facebook post. This is from Michael. We are all guilty of signing things without reading. It should be enlightening for many to learn that signature gatherers are not actually required to tell the truth and are often paid to push a certain agenda. The proposed referendum question is typically at the top of the sheet they're asking people to sign. But as we've discovered, the amount of people that actually read and understand what they're signing is far less than 100%. I hope this will be a lesson to all Mainers and people will be more diligent about what they sign in the future. Greg, what Michael is talking about is the vaccination referendum, the referendum petition drive that would repeal Maine's new vaccination law.
So we regularly hear complaints from people who say that they were lied to by petition gatherers. And there were more of those complaints this time around than in some most recent ones. People were told that one of the ones that if you're pro-choice, you should sign this. And really what they meant was, are you pro-choice about vaccinations, not about abortion and other things like that, that sort of misleading descriptions. And the fact is, you can't. There's no law that says you can control what somebody says in the political arena. Ultimately, the choice is made by the voters, who's telling the truth and who isn't. And you really wouldn't want the government weighing in and coming down and saying, oh, no, that political argument is not true. So it's out of bounds. You know, you can only say this. So I think that's part of what people are finding. But, the reality is you have to read the petition, and they're required by law to have it with them.
We have lots of calls and lots of topics here, so I'm going to go right to Kai in Kennebunkport. Hi, Kai. Go ahead.
Yes, good afternoon. First of all, I would like to say I am for wind and solar, but listening to your conversation, everything wants to go over to electricity, and I would like to make known that Quebec Hydro is closest to Maine than any other thing. They have 63 hydro dams in working order as we speak.
So you're advocating Maine buying more power from Hydro, Hydro Quebec?
We could take down the old dams and rejuvenate the fish population.
Sure, Kai, and Governor LePage wanted us to do that as well. Ben?
I think Hydro is certainly part of the mix. When you look at it, it's already part of the mix in Maine. Judging from, the other story that Hydro Quebec is involved in, it might be a little difficult at this point to get to convince people to bring even more hydropower from Quebec in.
And you're referring to?
For the Central Maine Power wants to ship it over Maine sort of to Massachusetts, and that's becoming a big problem. Maybe if it was coming directly to Maine, it'd be a little different.
Well, it is coming directly to Maine, and if you're counting the electrons where they actually get used, they'll be used in Maine. They offset power that will
we're on the same grid.
That we'll be sending to Massachusetts. So it's not like it skips over Maine, but it's yes, there is hydropower, and like every other kind of electricity and energy generation, there are trade-offs, and and you'll hear from people who find those trade-offs to be unacceptable. But that's the kind of thing that we're going to have to do if we're going to electrify things that are not run by electricity now.
Kai, thank you for your call. I'm going to move on to another topic. Toss this one to you, Susan Young. A tweet from Murray. Can the panel discuss LUPC rezoning Irving Lands in Arista County and Weyerhaeuser dropping its development plans near Moosehead Lake? Now, somebody listening to this quickly might not quite know what Murray's talking about. Weyerhaeuser dropping its development plans near Moosehead Lake, otherwise known as Plum Creek dropping its development plans near Moosehead Lake. Susan, many of us spent a lot of time covering this issue a decade ago, and suddenly, poof, it's gone.
Yeah, I mean, the easy answer is the economy changed. I mean, as you say, Jennifer, it was very controversial when Plum Creek petitioned to rezone a lot of the land it owned around Moosehead Lake for various different kinds of development. They, I think, ended up proposing three different plans. They upped the amount of conservation that was in the plan so that land was conserved for the people of Maine. Ultimately, that plan was approved by, I think it was still the Land Use Regulation Commission, and then nothing happened for years and years. And Weyerhaeuser took over Plum Creek's land in Maine. And looking at the economy, the decreased demand for summer homes, they decided that they don't need all this land to be developable. So they want it to go back more just for tree growth. So it's a very interesting story. Plum Creek, foresaw that there would be all kinds of demand for people from southern New England and other parts of the country to come here to recreate and to either have a second home, or they hoped some people would even relocate here. And with economic changes, it just didn't happen. So interesting how it all worked out.
We have an email from John Bolduc. I'm a journalist with the Sun Journal based in the Advertiser Democrat in Norway. A big story this month was the sentencing of Robert Trundy, a hunter sentenced to 7 years in jail with all but 9 months suspended for the 2017 death of Karen Rentzel. Many, including the family of Rensel, disagreed with the light sentence. The Bangor Daily did a great job of explaining why Trundy received the sentence he did, but it's an incredibly emotionally charged case, especially in a small town like Hebron. Also, the discovery of a body in Norway allegedly buried by an 84-year-old friend has the potential to be incredibly interesting. So, John, thanks for listening and thanks for adding that. And maybe I'll just throw out to my panel here, are there any other stories that you're kind of watching now that are maybe a small story now but might get bigger pretty soon?
I had completely forgot about the woman who buried her friend in the backyard. That, you know, that's one of the stories. You see that there was a body found in the backyard, and you think, oh, that was a, you know, a missing person, and what's the story going to come out to? And then it's completely different than what you thought. And then it kind of ends with the coda that it's, you know, it's legal to bury someone in the backyard as long as you get a permit for it. Yeah, it was a pretty bizarre story, oddly sweet in some ways, that these two friends, but it's just a strange one. One that you know, when it comes up in a newsroom, everybody can't stop talking about it.
Yeah, and may find its way into a Stephen King novel.
Yeah, right.
We have a tweet from Marfine. The Maine Sunday Telegram had a great piece on Chamrun Feng, who was deported back to Cambodia because of a conviction from 20 years ago. What are your thoughts on executive pardon petition before Governor Mills, and will that matter to the Trump administration? Marfine's mentioning Maine Sunday Telegram, so Greg, I'll toss this one to you.
So this is a case, there was a number of these cases right after 9/11. They were involved immigrants who came from countries or were the nationals of countries that did not accept. We didn't deport people to. I forget what the term. We didn't have a reciprocal arrangement. There was a couple of these cases where after 9/11, the Bush administration announced that they would start deporting people back to places like Cambodia. And this guy, Chamrun Feng, was a... came over here as a toddler. I think he might have even been born in a refugee camp. Did not speak Cambodian. Didn't have any kind of connection with the culture. I'm going blank on what he was arrested for, but it was some kind of assault. It was a fight. It was some kind of ongoing thing. Normally, a 19-year-old gets arrested for fighting and goes to, you know, maybe spends a night in jail and goes, stands in front of a judge and gets a stern talking to. And in this case, he lost his green card and became deportable. And that was a while back. I think that was somewhere around the first decade of the 2000s. And now under the current administration, they are going back and looking at those cases. And he was deported back to this country where he, you know, does not really have any connection with. And I guess the question, Marfine's question was, do we have high expectations that the governor's pardon is going to change the administration's position? And I guess I don't have such high expectations, but I don't think that the current president is going to be president forever. And there may well be some more enlightened immigration policy down the road. So probably a governor's pardon couldn't hurt. And I think the argument for the pardon is how, you know, and the 14th Amendment requires equal protection under law. You have two people who commit the exact same offense. They shouldn't have such incredibly disparate outcomes where one person gets a slap on the wrist and another person gets sent halfway across the world to a place where they're a total stranger.
We'll go to Cheryl calling from Portland. Go ahead, Susan.
There are certainly parallels to the Lexia St. Martin case, the man from Haiti who the governor has pardoned, and you know he has already been deported as well. So, you know, to your question, what will the Trump administration do? We're certainly waiting in that case to see, you know, if he is allowed to return to Maine.
We'll go to Cheryl calling from Portland. Hi, Cheryl. Go ahead.
Hey, thank you. I'd like to return to the matter of impeachment. And I'm very certain that most individuals would like to think that we've, how do you say, gotten beyond that. We've gone to other issues. But seeing as how important this is, I'd like to make a comment. And that comment is, I am continually disgusted how the pundits try to suggest that we consider how the vote of our representatives would affect them politically. I really don't care how the vote affects Susan Collins or Jared Golden or Angus King or Shelley Pinger. I don't care how it affects them politically. I care how their vote affects the country and our representation and our state as a democracy, as a representative democracy. I care how their vote affects the country.
Sure, Cheryl, I think that you are not alone. I know a lot of people are frustrated not only with how and why politicians make their decisions sometimes, but how the media covers that. Ben, I'm going to put this to you. It's just a fact of the matter, right? I mean, it is just a fact.
Well, impeachment is a political tool. It's not legal. It is a political avenue for removing a president when something has happened that has broken his trust with the American people. And that's a very hard thing to come to. It has all these different factors. And one of them is how the people feel at home, whether that's because of you want to represent your district or because you want to stay elected. There's all these things. At some point, as you saw, with the Nixon impeachment, it reached a point where people couldn't deny it any longer politically, that there was something wrong and that there was that they had to act. And so individuals getting there is, there's so many different factors that go into it for each of these individuals, senators and congressmen to come to, that they're considering all these different things. It's just a fact of human behavior.
All right. Well, that's going to be our last word. We're out of time. I apologize to any of you hanging on the phone or an email I haven't gotten to. Very popular program today. Thank you. That was Ben Bragdon, editorial page editor for the Kennebec Journal and Morning Sentinel. Susan Young, also with us, the editorial page editor for the Bangor Daily News. And Greg Kesich, editorial page editor for the Portland Press Herald and Maine Sunday Telegram. Nikki Shields ran the board today. We had additional help from Rich Tozier. All sorts of resources and past shows at MaineCalling.org. Maine Calling is produced by Jonathan Smith and Cindy Hahn. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You've been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.